NRI Wellness brings you the latest health and nutrition information, creates customized nutrition programs, and walks you through the process to ensure your success.
Good morning, good evening, good night, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to the 10 Dimensions of Wellness. I am your host, the owner of NRI Wellness, Chef Cammie Red. And on today's show, I am so happy to have this young lady here. We have Miss Wendy Cunningham. Now, Wendy is a researcher. She is a health education specialist, and she's doing some really big things out here in our community. So, Wendy, I want you to tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, how you got started, what set you off on this wellness journey.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. You speak so highly of me. Now I have to live up to that. But I'm from Detroit originally. I grew up in the 80s, born in the 70s, and under some pretty extraordinary circumstances, but I will say they were a little common. And that's one thing I want to touch on, and that's some of the circumstances that I experienced as a child growing up in Detroit were common. And because of that, we tend to normalize things that we shouldn't normalize. And that means they don't really get addressed like they should be. So growing up,
a lot of adults walking around carrying childhood trauma.
Exactly. And what we're told when we're younger is, you know, get over it. It happened to me. So pretty much what's the big deal? And things aren't necessarily said verbatim like that, but that's the general meaning that you get as a child, which is what happened to me isn't really that big of a deal. So when I'm talking about some of the things that happened to me, I'm talking about growing up in a home and an environment where drugs were so very common, from marijuana to cocaine use to crack use, even to heroin use, that people really don't take a double look at a child being exposed to those sorts of things. And then there's the verbal, physical and sexual abuse, the sexualization of children to the point where they really aren't being watched like they should be. And part of that goes back to the drugs, because you can't really keep an eye on your family when you are under that type of influence and the people that you attract are doing those things. So, you know, that pretty much was my home environment. You know, with my father being involved in drugs, and he died when I was 11, and my mother being involved in drugs and attracting that sort of company put me at a huge risk. And so I was violated sexually. And some of the things that happened, I do believe happened because, you know, people were just, they just weren't sober. They weren't in their right minds. And they couldn't make those sorts of decisions. So school was an escape for me. It was a sober place. It was a safe place. It was a place I felt protected, where I was kind of taken seriously, where I really wasn't growing up. And that's because when you're growing up in that sort of environment, drugs take priority. And getting high and getting your next high and numbing out and not connecting and living into reality is the norm. So I really kind of thank God, though, that I had that safe haven of school, because it really was what held me and held me together in a sense. It gave me a little bit more direction and identity and purpose. And that was pretty much my way out of those sorts of experiences and that sort of environment. Just being able to latch on to that, achieve and have goals to go to college and kind of do something with my life, something a little bit different. It offered me just something different, and I did manage to latch on to that and not become so sucked in to drugs. Now, I'm not, that sort of lifestyle. I'm not going to say that I escaped it completely, 100% altogether. I'm not going to lie. It was a period in my life where I was what you call a binge drinker. And again, you know, growing up back then, those sorts of words, we didn't understand what those sorts of things were called. We had an understanding of like what an alcoholic was or, you know, something like that. But I had never heard of anything called a binge drinking back then. So, you know, growing up in Detroit, I was sold beer, 40s, Night Train 2020. I remember I'm 18, 19, definitely under the age to drink. But again, because it's so normalized, it was no problem for me to go into the liquor store at that age and buy Night Train 2020 and a 40 ounce and drink it so quickly.
Girl, you speaking to see, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, it's not just 19 and 18. It's actually, in some cases, it's 14 and 15 and 13. So it's younger generations, you know, that are exposed to the same thing. Like what you just said, it literally brought and sparked up some memories from my childhood. I do remember I lived in the South, going to Winn-Dixie at 16 and being able to purchase. Right. 2020 and Strawberry Bones Farm, all the stuff y'all hear about, the old rappers talking about, this is real life.
Exactly, yes. Strawberry Bones Farm. And when, you know, back in the day, there weren't even wine coolers back then or popular fruity drinks that we had access to. What we had access to in our community were those sorts of like St. Ives sort of drinks. And without that kind of health education or the guidance, I had no idea what it was doing to my body and what malt liquor does to your brain.
To your body, and your brain. Oh, my gosh. A lot of people don't understand when I say I don't drink alcohol, why I don't. It's a process of, you know, just everything. So it's really, really not a healthy thing for you to consume.
No. But, you know, back then, health was the last thing on my mind. What was on my mind was coping with the stress and escaping it and doing what I know now, which was a sort of like an avoidance type of stress coping behavior. But again, when I'm growing up in that environment without mentors, without a lot of direction, I didn't have anyone sitting me down or talking to me or any sorts of groups or podcasts. Any information where someone was saying to me, what you're really trying to do is deal with this stress. And it's working, because the problem is it temporarily really does work. You do escape for that moment with the drinking, but it's not really addressing the root of the issue.
No, it's not gonna, it's the alcohol is what we call self-medication.
Yes.
It's not getting what you need to have what's done, what we in our industry call root work, where we actually delve deep into what's going on beyond the surface to trigger these behaviors and habits.
And if someone had told me that 20 years ago, I wouldn't have had to go on that healing recovery journey alone and learning all of these terms and what was really happening to me. And that's what I call it. I was on a journey to learn my story. And 20, 30 years later, I learned my story, which is exactly that. What you're trying to do, what you really want to do is get to the root work. And what I eventually came to understand after I had to stop doing those self-medication types of things was really get to the root. And that was, I was coming from a legacy of stress and trauma, where it wasn't just me and it didn't start with me. And it wasn't like anyone sat me down and told me their story. Like I didn't have my uncles telling me their story. My father, my mother, they didn't tell me. I heard bits and pieces of, you know, most of my uncles being on drugs or passing away, or not knowing any of my grandparents, or my father not growing up with a father. But there were reasons behind all of that. And normally, typically, looking back now at almost 50, I can see it was probably because they had their own trauma that they were going
through. Yeah, one of the things that we're learning and that I'm starting to see more and more is that, you know, in order for us to be born, we have to think about all of the trauma that has occurred over the past 400 years. That's a lot of trauma that's being passed down generation after generation. So just imagine how you felt like your childhood was traumatic because of the way they, you know, you were raised. How traumatic was your parents' childhood because of how they were raised? So we actually pass this trauma on to our children.
Exactly. And again, I wish you were there then to tell me that, because I had to work through all that bitterness and hatred and confusion to understand what I was feeling. And what I was feeling was, like you said, almost like 400 years worth of women trauma being transferred down to me. And I'm physically not understanding what I'm feeling, but on a spiritual level, you feel that you're carrying it. And it is so heavy.
Yeah, see, like African-American women. Yeah, African-American women the most. We actually suffer from that the hardest. We walk around carrying the weight of the world, which is why you find so many of us self-medicating, suffering from anxiety and depression, having underlying trauma that causes other type of ailments and diseases in our body, because trauma doesn't just affect you mentally. It causes high blood pressure. It can lead to diabetes. It can lead to cancer. So it can affect your body as well. That's why African-American are such a high risk for heart disease as well.
Right. You know, and it's so good to have this conversation with you, because like I said, it's so long overdue to put this type of awareness out there to really help someone else so that they won't have to learn all of this over 40 years, 30 years. You know, it only got to the point where I had my own three children and they were getting older and older and older. And I realized how me not dealing with things was really impacting them. And that's when, you know, I mean, but they were older, not too much older, you know, 10, 12. But I said, you know what, I don't want to be the one that continues to pass this down. I've got to figure this out. And once I did, I said to myself, okay, this is wonderful that I've learned it. It's wonderful I can begin to recover and put the pieces back to my life. But gee, it would be nice to have lots of this information condensed in a way that we can have it so we can cope and deal with it, and we won't have to deal with it alone. And that's what got me trying to figure it out all on my own. Deal with the stress on my own.
Yep. And that's what we do. But that's also been instilled in us as well. That's actually a part of our trauma, is we've been taught not to seek help and to keep our feelings inside and to not tell anybody when we're sad, when we're depressed, when we're feeling anxious, because we've been taught those are signs of weakness. But that's not true. You actually have to seek help.
And that's really what I learned, you know, after almost going through a suicide, you know, after cutting myself, after binge drinking, after domestic violence, you know, after going through all these things, I thought to myself, I need to get serious about opening my mouth, get my voice and my power back, break the power of silence, and get help. But coming from trauma, I have this horrible mindset. You can't trust anybody. Nobody cares. What is anybody going to do anyway? What's going to happen to me? Is this just the end? Little did I know, there was so much information out there. There were so many other people that had recovered before me. There's so many professionals that had options for me. You know, I didn't even know what the word recovery was. I didn't know that was what I was supposed to be doing. But, you know, lo and behold, going through, you know, the public health program, going through different social support programs, going through church small groups, I'm now at the point where I really have put a lot of the pieces together. And I'm just like, it's time to start telling more and more and more people, because we've got to stop this intergenerational trauma and begin to learn how to recover in a more healthier way.
Yes, we do. We've got to, and you know, one of the things that I often say is I am my sister's keeper. And that's because what happens is we have to start funneling information to each other. We have to start, you know, readily passing down healing and helping techniques to each other, so that when you are feeling a certain type of way, as another female, I should be able to say, hey sis, I was feeling this way, this is what happened to me, and these are the steps that I took in order to help me feel better. This is the doctor that I sought, here's their number, let me make a recommendation for you. We've got to start doing that for each other.
I agree 100%, and it's so important that we replace some of the things we're doing now, because we really think it's helping us, like the shaming, you know, the shaming of one another. And I do believe the intentions are there for Christians, and I am a Christian, but we don't want to always make someone feel that they're less saved or they're less of a Christian because they want to get counseling, or there's something wrong with their walk because they are not, quote unquote, where they're supposed to be because they've confided in someone else. And, you know, when you trust someone else with your story, you got to be so careful they don't re-traumatize you.
And see, that's the other piece. What you just said, and I hate to say this, and I'm not speaking ill against any religion, but religion also plays into some of the trauma that we have. We've been told so many things, like, believe it or not, the Bible actually says that you should seek help. You should have a healthy mentality. The reason why God gave us free will is so that you had the ability to make choices on your own. You are not supposed to be unwell. Having trauma in your life is not the way that you are supposed to be. The Bible says, do not suffer. So suffering can look any type of way. So regardless of whatever religion you are, you actually have to make this work for your life. It's not a standard across the board. It's what works and what fits. And like you said, we have to stop shaming each other for seeking help.
We do. And it's so important because, you know, I was doing some reading about how women cope with stress. And a doctor out of Kent State, Dr. Angela Neal Barnett, she said women tend to not just tend and befriend when we're going through our stress, but she says we tend, befriend, mend, and hold it in. And some of those things, we got to tweak it a little bit, but when we tweak it, we got to put some education with it. And that's when, like you said, when I'm going to you and I'm telling you what I'm going through, let's not shame one another.
That's right.
Because the way that I choose to recover and cope with what happened to me, it may not be the way you cope with it, but it's the way that I've learned to cope with it. And 9 times out of 10, some of these ways that we cope, whether it's smoking marijuana, sex, food, shopping, beauty, you know, excessive makeup or clothing, whatever way you tend to cope with and deal with it and make yourself feel better, sometimes those are coping strategies we picked up from childhood, and they worked. That when we start to get older and we want different things in life, we have to adjust our coping strategies to align with our goals. Because sometimes, you know, well, I want to get married, I want to have a house, I want to have a career. Okay, well, having that strategy of silence and doing everything on your own and keeping it in, it probably isn't going to advance you towards your goals. You got to learn, renew your mind. You have to have a paradigm shift throughout this journey. And it's not just for those of us who have been through something. And that's what people, you know, it really gets aggravating. Those people that have been through something, you know, this is a us thing. This is not just a Wendy thing. This is a family issue, a community.
Say it again,
issue.
Girl. This is us. This is all of it.
Because like with COVID, where we have to, when one of us gets it, the exposure, and if you're not treated and protected, you're going to spread it. And it's the same thing with trauma. People, they draw this line and they think of, well, women like Wendy, you know, the ones that are unmarried and had children, or the ones that binge drink. And I'm not like those women. Yeah, but if you're working in this industry or this group, and you're working with people like that, and you're re-traumatizing them by the things that you're saying, you're part of the problem and you're part of what's going on. And that's a huge point I want to make, is that there are those that want to get help and recover, and there are those that people are reaching out to. And we have to learn how to handle with care when people tell us our trauma and recovery stories, and shaming and judging a person for dealing with abnormal circumstances, because all of this is completely abnormal, you know.
Did you know that the average person carries around 5 to 20 pounds of fecal matter in their intestines, depending on their diet? Some people are walking around feeling sluggish, constipated, unable to lose weight, skin issues, and allergies, all because of the toxins that are in their intestines. Listen, life gives us enough battles to fight. Your health shouldn't be one of those. If you change your mindset on how you actually view food, you will never have to worry about your health or weight again. I'm Ashley, owner of She Loves Wellness. I help people transition into a healthy lifestyle. I offer tips, recipe, and supplement kits to jumpstart your lifestyle change. Visit me on Facebook and IG at She Loves Wellness for your product information and samples. Don't forget, it's not a diet, it's a lifestyle change.
Now, Wendy, tell me, what makes you feel inspired or feel like your best self?
You know, I learned something about myself during the recovery journey, and that is how much I love to move and exercise. And I know it may sound crazy to a lot of people.
No, that actually makes sense, girl. No, that does. Because believe it or not, exercising and moving cleans out your system, and sweat detoxes your skin and your blood. So if you are coming out of recovery, actually working out and exercising does increase your endorphins and make you feel happier.
And that's what happened to me. I was sad and distraught and stressed out, but I knew I liked to walk, especially in Detroit, because we're right there by the Detroit River, and we have Belle Isle and the Riverwalk. And what I would notice is when I would start walking with my headphones on by the water, I would feel like a completely different person. And I would have this renewed sense of energy. And internally, in my mind, in my spirit, in my soul, I was different. I was glowing, happy, optimistic, funner, lighter. And so I began to connect the dots the more I read, and what you said was what I was beginning, what I read and what was happening to me. And that is, for me, the biggest key to recovery was moving my body, getting out into nature, because I was beginning to decrease some of those other hormones like cortisol and adrenaline, and I was beginning to have an increase in some of the quote-unquote happy hormones.
Yep.
Like you were saying, what I'm doing is recalibrating. And for me, that's what recovery was. My stress response system was always activated since probably before I was born. It was a chronic activation of a stress response system, the flight or fight. And what I learned was I had to turn it off. And I'm thinking to myself, well, how the heck am I supposed to turn off my flight or fight? When I tell you, this recovery journey has been so wonderful for me to understand how I can interact with my environment and control.
Yes, yes. See, this being well is a journey, but once you get to that place, oh my God, it's a gift.
It is a gift. It's so empowering to even watch myself and how God created our bodies and my body. And that's, you know, Wendy, you can get through this. And that was the key for me. You got to go through it. And what I had to learn was, Wendy, when you begin to feel this type of way, quote unquote, how are you going to respond to it? Because that was the key. It's my responsibility, how I respond to stress, no matter how unfair and unjust it is, what are you going to do? So I had to come up with what I called a recovery plan. And one of the biggest things for me was getting out and moving and walking. And having three sons, that wasn't hard at all. Because if they're not playing football, you know, they're doing something else physical. Not to say that was very sexist of me. Not to say girls don't do things like that.
No, I'm there with you. I got three boys. And okay. Literally, like 21, 13, 3. You don't say less. You don't have to say nothing else. I understand.
But I think God knew, not I think, let's listen how I said, I think. God knew what he was doing when he gave me sons. You want to talk about inspiration. I'll admit, I had a horrible view of men before I had my sons. And I had to do a lot of soul searching to understand the root of that. And part of it, you know, was because I kind of got the notion from my environment, well, what do you need a man for? You know, men are, they're going to hurt you. They're going to do this. So in my mind, because my biological father wasn't around, I really began to think that men aren't as important in the family and in my life as they really are, because my uncles weren't around, they were on drugs and things like that. But when I had three boys and I watched them grow up, it completely shifted my idea of manhood and what men are truly about. They inspire me so much, because I want so much for them as their mother. And I know that they have to make their own decisions, don't get me wrong. They really do. But it's my job to encourage and affirm and support them in learning who they really are. And who they really are, you know, are born leaders, born, you know, people that have a right to take their position in society. They're not supposed to just be beaten down and cast aside. So what inspires me is knowing that I wanted to break that cycle, but I said, in order for me to teach them, because I was a single parent most of their life, I had to embrace those qualities myself. I had to believe in myself. You can't teach anyone something if you don't hold it and you don't believe it.
Not That's just right.
Me, but you got to walk the walk and talk the talk.
You got to walk the walk and talk the talk. Now, let me ask you this. What's something you that people seem to misunderstand about you?
That I'm vulnerable. Having three sons and working and going to school and wanting to be successful and achieving things, people don't think I need help or I need assistance, because they see this quote-unquote strong Black woman.
And I think, girl, if we don't get beyond that strong Black woman syndrome.
We got to shift so many things in our culture for the good of our culture. And this idea that the Black woman like me or anyone else, she doesn't need anything because she can quote-unquote handle it. She can deal with it. She can hustle her way through and she'll be all right and all of these other things. And this idea that, you know, we don't have permission to be vulnerable or weak or need things or to really cry and still be looked at as strong and as women. And
and that's really sad, because, you know, even as a woman, you know, the one thing that we should be allowed to do is be vulnerable and find someone and other people that we can be vulnerable with, because we need that. We need that air of vulnerability, even if it's just with one person. We need to be able to let loose, let that wall down, and just be emotionally okay.
Exactly, without being judged and shamed or having it held against you or thrown in your face at a later point in time.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, the same like we were saying with sweating. Crying is a detox. It's a process that I have to go through, you know, that we have to go through. It's the same as repressing any type of emotion. What it's going to do is, it's going to put Wendy at more risk for heart disease, stroke, and hypertension if yes, I don't release some of these things. Mm-hmm. So the more, you know, the older I get, the more I go on this journey, I understand what it is that I'm striving for is balance and health. And being vulnerable is healthy, is natural. It's just that we have to find safe places and safe people to be vulnerable with. And it's not that they don't exist. I will never say that. There are good people in this world, and there are people that can be trusted no matter what color or gender. There are good people out here. That's a horrible way to live. You can't trust anybody. Nobody cares. Nobody's going to listen. You know, like I said, we have to have a paradigm shift. And, you know, yes. I did, and it's the best thing that happened to me. So right now I have people, you know, like you said, it doesn't have to be a million. And I know the difference between who I can be vulnerable with and who I can. And that's a skill. This is called discernment.
That's right.
You can't be vulnerable till you have to mature and really be able to see who can I trust my story with, because it's important. Valuing yourself, your story, and understanding you have needs. I'm telling you, growing up in an environment where you're constantly told you're invisible and what happens to you doesn't matter, you carry that into adulthood. So now you're an adult and you really believe, I don't matter. It doesn't matter if someone was just discriminated against me. I was raped. I was passed over. That's just life. That normalization right there is such a key part of our health disparities and what's happening with us. It's not to blame us, but it is to understand where our power is, and that's with our voice. If something within in our intuition innately is telling us this isn't right, we have every right to speak up for ourselves and get the help and treatment that we need. It's a human right.
You are absolutely right. And we should. Like, that's what we have to get across to our cohorts, our sisters, our brothers, you know, that it's okay. Like, you speak up, say what's on your mind. Don't allow that stiffness in your throat. Get out, say it, get it, speak it, you know, even if you can't express the words, write it down, journal it, do something, but you got to get it out.
Pray it out. Sing it out.
Thank you. But get it out.
Get it out. Find your own unique way to express yourself. My sister, she didn't realize she could draw so beautifully until she was, I think she was over 40. And she was going through her recovery journey. And she began to produce these beautiful pieces of art. And she didn't even realize that was inside of her. It's a journey. Can't be just a thought because you don't know what your particular way is, but that's the fun of it. You got to get out there and be creative. You can't let fear hold you back. Well, I don't know how to sing. Well, I don't sing that well. Well, I don't know how to sew or draw.
Well, everything is a practice too.
Exactly.
So if you start something, just keep practicing. Like they say, practice makes perfect. Even though perfection is an illusion, practice makes you better.
It's we want to get to the end. You know, I used to always ask myself, well, how do you know you're recovered? When you stop asking yourself, how do I know I'm recovered? It's a journey, and you're recovering every step you make. It all goes into the process. Every little small stroke you make with that paintbrush, every word you write, every affirmation you speak, everything that you do that's positive and healthy to help you heal, it adds up. It's cumulative. It really is cumulative. So embracing that concept that is cumulative steps, cumulative healing is so important. But what's also important is celebrate every step you make towards your recovery. Celebrate it. Every time you write a chapter or write a paragraph for it, you don't have to wait until your entire book is written in order to celebrate and determine that you're recovered. Every verse of a song, every dress that you make, every blog post that you write, everything that you do matters, and it is cumulative, and you will reach a point like me, like I did, where you really have discovered who you really are, because trauma can change you. I can't stress that enough, how trauma can change you. But when you take those steps of finding out who you are naturally, what your strengths are, what do you like to do? What have you always wanted to do? What have you always wanted to say but didn't say? What have you felt but you repressed it? The tears you wanted to cry but didn't. When you begin to realize, embrace, admit, and take action on those sorts of things, you will get to a point, like I said, where you really are your true authentic self. You're not a version of yourself, but you really are who God intended you to be.
Let me ask you, what's been one of the biggest challenges you've had on your journey, and how did you overcome that?
Well, I've had so many, but I'm going to stick with the one I've been talking about so far, and that's using my voice. When I tell you that I did not want to be seen or heard, you probably couldn't imagine the beliefs I held. I did not want to take a picture. I don't even have that many pictures of myself from when my children were younger, because my beliefs were, what, you have no value, your voice has no value, your presence has no value, so therefore stick to what you know and what you're accustomed to, what you've adapted to. You're a hider. So I was they expanded the flight or flight to include freeze and some other things too, but flight or freeze. And that's when you're traumatizing, when you're faced with something. I was a person that just froze. I didn't speak, I didn't move, okay. I didn't do anything. I just hid, and I was so thin growing up. It was easy because nobody wanted to be bothered with me because I didn't look this way. And I carried that with me for so many years. I had ideas of being a journalist and a writer and an advocate, but I used to think to myself, well, nobody wants to hear what I have to say, so I'll just go back and hide and pretend and just be invisible. It was such a huge obstacle for me. It was one of those kinds of things, I hated the way I sounded on tape. Most people do, but I mean, it was just a deep hatred. I didn't want to see myself, hear myself, or anything like that. I just wanted to rush through everything. How did I get through that? It was just an intentional choice, and the desire to advocate for women that have been through things like me and to be a role model for my sons was greater than the fear. And I knew there was no way I could get to the other side of where I wanted to be unless I made myself visible, unless I spoke. And I dodged it for so many years, but it got to a point where, I couldn't freeze anymore. I couldn't hide. And I had to just face myself in the mirror. I had to just look myself, face myself, face my fears, and say, are you really ready to blow it all and give it all up because you want to hide? And I'm thinking to myself, well, yeah. But then I said, no, you don't, you're a winner. No, you what you're doing is hiding. I don't know. I just, tiny steps. It wasn't huge. There wasn't some transformation overnight. It was small steps of speaking up. It may have started with going to a counselor and then going to a support group. And then, and this is a true story, you know, going to another support group. And then I would go to a facilitator's meeting and really entertain the idea of not just being in a support group, but running the support group. And not just a support group, but being in a, doing a presentation where I actually have to speak and show slides and tell my story and things like that. And that's exactly what happened. I went from being in the group to running the group, from being in the audience of a presentation and thinking, oh, I want to be like her, till I slowly got myself to the point where that was me. So I had lots of support to get me to that point, but that was the biggest hurdle. And I guess you really could say it was learning how to be me. But I definitely mastered it now. I'm comfortable with who I am, and I can show my true face. I can speak now without a whispering, without so much of a crackle in my voice, is because I had people tell me, you have something to say, say it. And it was a relief to finally get around people, even people that say, yes, you have something to say, say it. And it's not just for the audience's sake, it's for your own sake. And it was very, very liberating and empowering to finally be able to do that.
NRI Wellness brings you the latest health and nutrition information, creates customized nutrition programs, and walks you through the process to ensure your success.
This is 2 Second Nutrition Tips. Today's tip is go an entire week without eating fast food, and then see if you can do it again the next week. Let me know how it goes. This has been a 2 Second Nutrition Tip.
If you want to be seen, you have to stop being invisible to opportunity. I'm Kay Henry, licensed mental health counselor and host of Black Therapy Uncensored. Your prescription to positivity starts here.
Okay, Wendy, so tell me what's next for you. What do you have going on right now in your world?
Thank you for asking. I am so excited about my dissertation. I'm a student at an HBCU, Florida A&M, and like I was telling you earlier, school is where I felt safe. But when I started this program 5 years ago, I was just in the kind of middle beginning stages of my recovery. What I didn't realize was starting this program was really going to be the beginning of the end of my recovery process, because I really learned the health impacts of childhood trauma and adversity. And I learned that through the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. Now, this is a study that came out about 20 years ago. About 17 to 22,000 people in California took it, primarily white, primarily educated. But what they found was how common adversity is even among this group. And as it turns out, it was good that this was the group, because most people's tendency is to say childhood trauma and adversity is a minority people's issue, but actually it's not. It does not discriminate. Any groups can experience it.
Yes. So it's not just a Black people problem. It's an all people problem.
It is 100 and all. And that's what that project showed. Anyway, it's a seminal project, you know. Most people in public health know about it. What it shows is that it's a graded dose relationship between adversity and health. And a lot of people think trauma, okay, you're going to have PTSD, anxiety, and depression. That's true. I'm not saying that it isn't. But what they showed is the more adversity you have, the more you're going to have to be at risk for cancer, heart disease, diabetes, hypertension. So they show that, yes, this is impacting us mentally, but it's also impacting us physically. It's really changing the way that our genes are expressed, and that's called epigenetics. It hits on the fact that our environment can turn our genes on and off. So that chronic exposure is turning on some genes that don't need to be turned on constantly, But there's also a way for our environment to turn those genes off. So what I'm doing with my study, and it's called the Arhart study, I'm looking at that original ACEs study, and I'm tweaking it and adjusting it for pretty much people like me, people like me and you, because Blacks and Black women, for one, we don't always trust research because of what happened with Tuskegee syphilis study. And, you know, women and minorities are just plain old. We're underrepresented in research. They're not including us. So I thought to myself, well, yeah, I'm a student, but still, this is my opportunity to go to people that normally no one's asking us what our story is. No one's coming to us and talking to us. It's just this assumption that our experiences look like everybody else's experiences, and that's not always true.
No, ma'am, that's not true at all. Our lives are different. We grow up differently. Our experiences are different, but you know, our trauma is just as real as theirs. Our issues are just as real as theirs, and we should be the first people that they're studying, because our stress levels tend to be higher than theirs as well.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I'm doing with this. I'm looking at Black women, and I'm also looking at Black women in the South and heart disease risk. Because here's what's going on. We already know, like you said, women process stress differently. When it comes to flight, or freeze, we tend to do something more called 10 befriend, or like Dr. Barnett said, 10 men befriend and hold it in. So we react to stress differently, and we have more stress. Basically because of discrimination, racial discrimination, sexism, and classism most of the time. And that's because a lot of us don't have the same socioeconomic status as non-minorities. And it's impacting our heart disease risk. It's impacting our hearts literally and symbolically. And that's why this study is so important to me. You know, at the end of the day, this stress is breaking our hearts. And the way that we are learning to cope with it, what I bring out in the study is being a strong Black woman. In some ways, it is helping us. We can't deny that our strength is not helping us be resilient and overcome things, real issues. But there has to be a cutoff point and a boundary. We can't wear a cape 24/7. We can't be constantly looked at as a group that can just do everything, be everything for everyone else except for ourselves. That's where the problem is coming in. You know, I could take myself as an example. You know,
and you know what? That's what we call a mammy complex. That's how we were raised. Yeah, that's what was instilled in us.
Yes.
That we were the bottom of the totem pole. Therefore, we were the last thing we needed to worry about, when in fact, that's what we need to worry about first. You can't take care of somebody else. You can't do for other people without taking care of yourself.
And so that is my point, and that's what I want to look at. There's actually a scale that Dr. Giscombe, and she's actually here in North Carolina, she helped to create, and it's called the Strong Black Woman Schema Scale. So you answer questions to determine how likely you are to do things like put yourself last before everybody else. And there's social support, which is another way that we tend to deal with stress, which is going to our friends for support. So here we are, Black women, we're faced with all of these stressors, and our hearts are literally breaking. And we believe that if we're strong enough and if we have enough support from our families and friends, that it will protect us from heart disease. And that's what I want to figure out. Is what we're doing enough? What's happening with Black women is that our diabetes, hypertension, and obesity levels are extremely exacerbated compared to the majority. There is no more polite way to say it. The obesity, and I'm not talking about a few extra pounds here and there, because there's a lot of debate among Black women that encouraging us to be thinner is a way of trying to take away our cultural identity. I'm not talking about a few pounds over the BMI or a few numbers. I'm talking about things like obesity, not overweight, and morbid obesity is rampant among our women. And so is hypertension and diabetes as a result.
But girl, you know you speak in my language, right? Like this is this is exactly what I preach to my followers and listeners. The fact that, you know, you stress out as much as you, like I have a program called 30 and 30 and it's lose 30 pounds in 30 days. And we call it a weight management program and not a weight loss program. And it's because yes, we focus on helping you lose weight, but the goal of the program is to retrain the way you talk and the way you think about food, the way you see food, the way you eat food, the way you adjust to it. And to also teach you about the stressors and the triggers in your life that lead you to eat the way you do, that lead to anxiety and depression, that lead to some of these unhealthy ailments in our lives. Like we give you meditation techniques, yoga. I even have a financial analyst who has done a video to show you how to bring about your budget so that your budget is no longer a stressor for you, because even the finances have an effect on the way you eat.
Exactly. And those are the types of programs and initiatives that I want funded, but I know in order for us to get that sort of support economically, that we have to bring numbers and evidence to support it. So that's really where I want the research to go. It's not to just say, this is where we are. It's to provide evidence to support, this is what we need. And those are programs just like that. And it's called trauma-informed care. You know, coming from a trauma and ACEs background, many people just don't understand emotional eating or emotional drinking like I was doing. So when they come to me and they say, stop eating chocolate. Every time you get stressed, you're going to Baskin and Robbins, you're having two candy bars or what have you. There's a reason, like you said, and that's because physiologically I'm trying to calm myself, and I really need to learn some different ways to calm myself. But there's another aspect to the food and the weight for a lot of women that does not get discussed, especially when it comes to trauma. And that's because it's not a risk for us. What it is for us is a safe place and a protective factor. That weight for a lot of women that have been sexually assaulted and abused, especially as children, is a way to keep men away.
I was just going to say, a lot of times that obesity is a way to keep people from being attracted to you, so you won't feel the way you felt when you were younger. That's the key that a lot of people are missing. A lot of people think their eating habits have to do with, you know, just the way they eat and this, that, and the third. I have to teach people that a lot of the way we eat, a lot of the makeup is derived from our emotions. We eat based upon how we feel and what's stressing us throughout the day. And we gain weight to make sure that people don't pay attention to us. The fat people always get pushed to the back of the room. Nobody's going to notice me if I have all this weight on me. But not realizing that, that's making people notice you even more and pay more attention to you and causing you more stress.
And it's ultimately killing us. See, we think we're doing good and we really are protecting ourselves because it does work. And I don't want to shame anybody that's obese because it works. But in the long run, is it really worth dying for? It's not worth dying for.
I'm all for the body positive movement. I'm all for that. I have no problem with you being happy where you are. I'm not shaming you in any type of way. But what I do know is the anatomy of the body. And I know that as happy as you claim to be, you're also dealing with some joint pain. You're also dealing with some other ailment issues. It may not be diabetes. It might actually be hypertension. It might be high cholesterol. It might be fatty liver disease. It could be anything. But having or carrying around that much weight is not healthy.
What you're telling yourself is this is the best way to deal with my trauma. And that's a lie. That's not the best way to keep yourself safe. You can keep yourself safe, just you, not you and the extra weight and the extra fat. You can keep yourself safe. You can protect yourself. And being in that survival mode 24/7 like that is just not plain old healthy to just live, to eat, to stay safe. But what I really want to touch on too is that what is teaching the younger generation? When we don't, especially as parents and mothers, when we don't deal with our stuff, like you said, we're just passing it down. 9 times out of 10, if that's your mentality, that's how you deal with trauma, self-medicate by food, drug, or wine, or men. If something, Lord forbid, was to happen to any, whether it's a son or a daughter, you would think you wouldn't be like that. But if that's the way you deal with your own trauma, how can you tell me you would deal with your child's trauma any differently?
That's what the parents don't get is your children learn from you. So your coping mechanisms are their coping mechanisms as well.
And we have to stop. We have to take a look at our generational trauma and what we're passing down, this legacy of disease. We want to pass down wealth, I sure do, and land and education. But if we're not healthy and I have a stroke at a younger age, my children are going to be taking care of me, and all of the wealth and all of the bonds, it's not going to mean as much if we don't have a legacy of health. So I want us to have freedom, and I want us to have wealth, but I also want us to have health. And we have to do this through policy, advocacy, and research. And those are three areas that I'm so glad Kamala is running, because we have to continue to forge ahead and seeing ourselves this way, that we're leaders, that we are capable of changing policy. We can advocate for things, but we can't do any of that if we don't know our ACEs story, if we don't know our trauma story, and we really believe that protecting ourselves with layers of fat is a way to address it. No, a way to address this is going on Capitol Hill. The way to address this is doing the research and participating in the research and funding the research that's going to answer some questions. Not just, I think, no, we have to learn to play the game and hustle. We know how to hustle other ways. It's about a hustle in order to get these things funded. In order to spread the word and improve our health, we have got to play the game. And this is what it's about. We have got to get in there and do the hard work. We've got to research is so very important. We have to heal from things like Tuskegee. There are so many people, so many health leaders like you that are doing the work. Everyone that's encouraging you to adopt a healthy lifestyle does not have a hidden agenda. Some people are in this work because they believe with their heart. This is a passion. This isn't a job. This is not a job at all.
Girl, I'm trying to figure out how to really make money doing this. What you talking about?
it is a passion.
It's a job, and we get paid for some of our services and coaching. But what people don't get is, in order to go into this field, you have to be passionate about this.
Right.
Because it's not just dealing with, healthcare. It's dealing with people, dealing with their personalities, dealing with their trauma, dealing with their emotions, and helping them work through all of that so that they can be a better person.
And it's not easy, and I commend you, because having a podcast, getting out here in the community, doing the hard work, talking about issues that sometimes people don't want to talk about, it's not popular, it's not easy, But someone's got to do it if we want to have some leaders in this community and we want to have some real change. And you know what? If we really want to survive, because at this rate, we are so unhealthy. It is questionable how we are even going to make it and how our children are going to fare at this rate, because we're getting diabetes, hypertension, obesity, we're having strokes earlier, heart attacks earlier. And before we realize it, in 10 to 20 years, the epidemic will be so out of control, it will be very difficult to manage. So when we do things like this, have these discussions, these call to actions, encouraging you to do these things, it is for the survival of our culture and our community. It's not an individual thing. It is a community.
People don't understand it. Yeah, say that again, because I don't think people grasp that in a clear fashion, that this is not to benefit us. This is not for us. This is not so that, you know, I can get out here and get my, I could care less. Y'all see, I host this under my business name. This is about getting the information out to the people so that they can utilize it in the way that it'll save their lives.
You know, back again, what I talked about in the beginning, and that's this normalizing things that should not be normalized, that are unhealthy, toxic, and dysfunctional. What this research is doing is bringing trauma and ACEs and heart disease to the table to say, we can talk about these things. You know, people used to think you can't talk about trauma. People are going to fall apart and even be more likely to harm themselves. It's going to trigger too many memories. People have taken the survey. People have talked about these sorts of things and have found just the act of listening and talking and sharing is so much of the healing process. Your health outcomes are going to improve. So this study is online. It's for women over the age of 18 that identify as a
Black. Can you tell women how they can actually, now I'm going to put a link up because we're going to do an article about Wendy, but I want you to tell women how they can actually sign up for this study.
Okay. You can go to ourheartstudy.org, ourheartstudy.org. I'm sorry, I botched that. You can look me up on Facebook. The study has its own website. When you go to the website, you'll see links that say participate here. Everything is online. You do not enter your name. It's confidential and it takes maybe 5 or 6 minutes. You answer questions about heart disease risk. Do you have hypertension? What's your weight? What's your height?
Then I'm it's not invasive at all. I've actually taken the survey. It actually helped me realize some things as well. So I think it's beneficial for all women. Now, it's only for women in Georgia, North Carolina, and in South Carolina and Florida, if I'm not mistaken.
Almost. North Carolina, Florida, Georgia, and Alabama. The 4 states. And that's because I couldn't do all of the stroke belt states. But we're living in the stroke belt, which means we have a higher rate and risk.
Yes, ma'am. I understand completely. That's one of the reasons I opened my wellness center in South Carolina, because they put me right in the middle of everything.
Yeah, and it's so important. But it's an online study. You take it one time. I don't bother you anymore after that. You answer the questions. And what I do is I take all of our answers, and I look at the relationships between the variables to see if this stress that we're experiencing, how is it impacting our hypertension, diabetes, how is it impacting us, and the social support work in mitigating and buffering that. Some parts of being a superwoman, is it really helping us? Because at the end of the day, I cannot stress, we have to be able to measure and quantify things if we want to get the funding. You know, we have so many dreams, and I am such a staunch advocate of leadership and entrepreneurship, but we have to have financial support. We have to be able to write those grants and get the funding and get the support from those that have a lot of money to do that. But in order to do that, we got to get our paperwork straight. but we also need to come to the table with evidence. And that's what this does. It's our story. And when I say our, Black women, it could be Caribbean, anyone that identifies with their skin being darker toned. It's not just for African American, Haitian, Cuban, whatever it is, if you identify as being Black, if you identify as being a woman, you do not have to be a heterosexual woman. I want to hear the voices from all of us that identify as women. So you, if you are transgendered and you identify as a woman, take the survey. If you have an orientation that is not cisgender, take the survey, because it is not just for straight, heterosexual, African-American women. It is for anyone who identifies as being a woman and being Black. And all of those experiences matter. All of those people matter. We're working towards equity, diversity, and inclusion here. That's what we need. We don't need everyone to be the same. Everyone can't be Caucasian, upper class, middle class, Ivy League, high socioeconomic status. We live in a diverse country, and that's what we need to start acting like. So anyway, this is our heart study, and it's for us.
So, Wendy, let's delve just a little bit deep into you and just show a little bit more of your personality. So, what's the biggest surprise that you've had in the last few months?
Oh, wow. It is coming from a place where I did not think people cared, because I had that in my mind. No one's going to listen. No one's going to support you. You're all alone. Coming from that place, to get into a place where I have been on your podcast, I have been on a Facebook Live show, I have had my story in the Tallahassee newspaper, and I have received so many responses to my survey. I cannot believe that I went from a scared place of opening up my mouth to within 60 days telling my story and actually having people listen to what I have to say and participating in the study. I never would have, it's humbling, but that has been a huge surprise for me.
That's really good. I'm so happy to hear that. And I'm really proud of you for this study and for everything that you have going on. So let me ask you this. What do you wish that you had known 10 years ago that you know now?
Oh, wow. 10 years ago. Oh, God, I'm going to be so vulnerable and honest here. Two things. I can't do one. I'm sorry. Two things. There are so many women and men that have good intentions and do not mean me or you harm. I was so threatened and was always on high alert, not want to be re-traumatized. I've always looked over my shoulder, so hypervigilant, because I'm always thinking someone's out to get me. You can't trust people. But you could have told me that 10 years ago, that there are so many good people out here that believe in what I believe in, that you can join with. It's not a competition, it's a community, and that's what it's called. Just get out there and learn how to trust and interact with other people. You will have what is called support in a family.
That is very true. It's community support.
It's a beautiful thing to realize you are not alone.
Yes. Now, let me ask you this. Looking back, what's been the biggest failure in this last year? And you can give a personal failure. You can give a global failure. I just want your opinion on what you think the biggest failure that you've seen this last year. And why do you think that happened?
Oh, God. This last year, I'm gonna keep it personal, and I would say letting my fears interfere with me being a good parent or being a loving parent. My son, he turned 17 in March, and he, just like me, 6'1", wonderful football player, smart, and all of them are I love them so much, all of them. But this one in particular he is a warrior. And to see, I have PTSD, to see how my fear of trying to protect him from something bad really interferes with him being a teenager and causes him a lot of anxiety. I had to really accept that I had failed him in that way of using him as a scapegoat to project all my fears upon.
And I, you know what? Let me say this to you. I think you just hit something in me that I didn't recognize in myself. And I think you probably just hit something in a lot of moms out there as well. Mm-hmm. What you just said about projecting our fears on our kids. You know, as African American mothers, we worry about a lot and we try to protect, especially our sons,
yes,
from the things that we know are out there in the world. And I, girl, if you didn't just say that, you made me look at my 21-year-old sideways when you said that. I was like, oh my, I need to go in here and talk to my baby.
You know, because I love them, and I love them with all my heart and soul, but it's like you said, it's these patterns I got to let go of and knowing when to let it loose a little bit and parenting from a place of fear. Of course we want, but fear and protection is not the same thing. And when it gets to the point where, like, it was getting from me, I mean, it was getting serious. Boy couldn't go anywhere without me lecturing and sweating and calling. I mean, it was a full-blown panic attack, anxiety, because I'm scared for everything.
You're not alone, though, Wendy. That's what I keep trying to say to you, is you're not alone in this, that particular fear. That's a fear, like, I'm going to be honest with you, and I can bring my 21-year-old in the studio to go to prove it, that I'm there with you. He's 21. He's not 17. He has to call me every 2 to 3 hours. But that's the reality of where we are in a society as well. Yes.
And I just want to find a healthier way. You know, I'm not saying it's going to go away, but it's got to be a balance to where he can still have a childhood and be a young adult and be protected. I don't want to heal, you know, because fear is one of them things, it just destroys everything. If I could do it from a place of love and protection instead of fear, worry, anxiety, death, terror, and dread, you know, that's different. So I'm learning, because he's forcing me to learn.
That's okay, girl. You learning and you teaching all of us. Because if you hadn't said that, I wouldn't have acknowledged it and I wouldn't have known either. So I get it.
Yeah, so that's a failure I'm working through. And one quick thing, and I'm going to tell you a true story. I had to have a real regular conversation with him, which was, I am scared that you might do this drug or that drug or do this, that, and the other, because that's all I know. That's all I've seen your uncles do. That's all I've seen this person do. And that's what I grew up around. And so that's where this is coming from. I'm just scared you're going to repeat the pattern that I have seen this person, that person do. And he looked at me and said, well, why did you just say that? I never knew that about this person. I never knew that about this. That's what happened? He said, well, that's what you just said. This is what's going on in my family? And I'm thinking to myself, well, did he know? And I'm like, oh, Lord, I'm so caught up in stuff. I'm not realizing he's not me. He don't know all the family history and all this.
I was just going to say, we forget that we have protected our kids. We have even protected them against what's within our own family.
Yes. And once you can see the difference. And
yeah,
he was like, oh, that's what's going on. And it changed everything. The dynamic, I'm not going to say perfect because he's not, but he can see where I'm coming from and he can see what's motivating me.
Yes. Okay, so this is my last question for you, and then we're going to tell our listeners how to get in touch with you. Now, if you could have a billboard with anything on it, what would it say and why?
Oh, wow. Okay. It would say simply, love wins. And that's because, I'll be honest with you, my name is Wendy, W-I-N-D-Y. I used to hate it and think, why would a black girl be named Wendy like that? Until I said, I twisted it and flipped it. I said, okay, I'm a winner. And then eventually I had I still have a good friend. Her last name is Love. And, you know, we're inseparable. We were playing around with the names one day. And she said, her name is Love. My name is Wynn. Oh, Love Wynn. And we've both been through a lot in life. And it just came to a point, you know what? The best way to deal with all of this stuff, to win this battle internally and in our environments, communities, and families, is love. It's no big fancy prescription drug intervention. It's the power of love. We underestimate it, but I guarantee you 100% of the time, if you're going through anything, when you prioritize love and doing things in a loving way and coming from a place of love, I just believe love never fails. And I didn't write that. That's in the Bible. Love always wins.
Girl, that's powerful. And you're right about that. Now, Wendy, why don't you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you? I know you gave out the website for the research project earlier, but give it again, repeat it, let them hear it again, give out how they can get in touch with you so they can find out. Those of you that are business owners that want to partner with Wendy in helping her with this research, go ahead and let them know how they can do that.
Okay. The name of the study website is ourheartstudy.org, and that's O-U-R, heartstudy.org. There's a contact us tab on the study website, and that really is one of the better ways to get in touch with me through that site. Or if you're on Facebook, send me a friend request or send me a direct message. And if it really is about the study or anything like that, my student email address is wonderful. It is Wendy, which is my name, Wendy, W-I-N-D-Y, then the number one, dot Cunningham at famu.edu.
All right, and I'm going to post all of this information on our website, nriwellness.com. There'll be an entire write-up on Wendy, as well as pictures and links to how you can sign up for this research project, as well as flyers that you can actually send out and post on your social media page as well. Once again, Wendy, I just want to say thank you so very, very much for coming on my podcast. It has been a pleasure having you as a guest today.
Thank you. You know, as I was telling you earlier, you know, you are the one I should be thanking. You are a leader. You have taught me so much in the very short time I have known you. You have helped me grow. You know, I'm all for education, and I love that I'm getting this degree, but I'm going to be honest with you. Having this type of mentoring and conversations with Wendy, what to do, and the opportunity, because you've already got it set up. I don't have to reinvent the wheel. The invitation to ask me questions. Wendy, what do you Wendy, this Wendy, you have no idea how wonderful this has been for me and my family and my children. I wish you all the best. I know that you will be successful. I love what you are doing. You are
Thank you.
You are genuine. You are the real deal. You have so much love emanating from you. So much wisdom. So much wisdom and wealth. And talent and organization and discipline. 4 o'clock in the morning, you said you get up?
Yes, ma'am.
I don't, thank you. I appreciate it, but no. Thank you. Okay? Thank you.
Yes, you follow me on Facebook. You get to see my posts, because even with my 3-year-old, I'm real life. It's not, you know, like I post conversations with a toddler, because at 4 o'clock in the morning, my 3-year-old is up with me. I'm doing yoga and he doing personal training type stuff.
Girl, he gonna be a bad member down the tube. He gonna be awesome. He gonna be awesome. So he already is.
Yeah. So guys, you can listen to our podcast on Spotify, iHeartRadio, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and a plethora of other platforms. You can also listen to this on YouTube, on our YouTube channel, which is nriwellness.com. Don't forget to download, share, comment. You know, all of our amazing guests are some really wonderful people in wellness. Check out all of our old ones, and then make sure that you set up notifications so that you can get new podcasts as well. Thank you guys for listening. This has been 10 Dimensions of Wellness, and I look forward to seeing you again next Wellness Wednesday.
NRI Wellness brings you the latest health and nutrition information, creates customized nutrition programs, and walks you through the process to ensure your success.